This episode of Silent E Goodness is brought to you by our friends, and hopefully soon to be your friends as well, the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club. This Pittsburgh-based organization is an amazing place for anyone who loves movies from the golden age of Hollywood. The Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club brings the fans of these movies together in celebration of these iconic silver screen gems. The mission of the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club is to promote and preserve classic films in the community by providing free screenings throughout the Pittsburgh area. The club has approximately 200 members. In addition to these fantastic film screenings, the club also offers virtual presentations and regular club meetings. Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club is led by co-president Wendy Wittick, who often gives insightful and informative film introductions at each screening. And if she doesn't, they have another presenter who gives equally great information. The Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club offers screenings and events at locations all over Pittsburgh. From theaters in the historic Carnegie Libraries, throughout the city to popular movie houses in the hippest neighborhoods of the Steel City, and even outdoor screenings in parks. No matter where you are, there is a great Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club event near you. The Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club also gives back to the community. At many showings, the group accepts canned goods and non-perishables to be donated to Western Pennsylvania area food banks, like they currently are doing for their Hitchcock series that's going on right now. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast love everything this group does and advocates for. We have had a great time at each and every screening we have attended. From silence to classics, their programming choices are always top-notch. And via those pre-movie introductions and talks, you get an inside look at some of these amazing films. There's a certain magic to seeing a classic film on the big screen. You can see something on a television or a computer screen. But watching these legends of cinema in a theater with like-minded movie lovers is a whole another level of cinematic experience. And the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club brings that magic in spades. And we can't say enough good things about this group and hope you'll give them a like and follow on any and all of their social media spots. If you're interested in joining the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club or just want to get on the mailing list for a schedule of events and other club-related news, you can do that by filling out the contact form on their website. Just head to Google or any search engine, type in Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club, and it's going to pop up there nice and easy for you. You can also find them on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram by searching Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club. There, you can stay up to date with upcoming film events, pictures from screenings, a lot of really cool information on their various social pages. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast hope to see you fine listeners at an upcoming screening. And again, want to thank the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club for all of their support of the show. Stan Laurel sought only to make his audience laugh. And out of that ambition, he created his art, writes Laurel biographer John Connolly. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the bloody hilarious and cinematically mudslinging arena of the Golden Silent Films podcast. If you enjoyed the marathon of an episode last time out, it is time for a little parody and satire brought to you by Stan Laurel. Grab your caramel, fish, and Vaseline, and sit back, enjoy some zany bullfighting and one of the earliest examples of a smoof movie. That previous list will eventually make sense. No weird stuff going on here, no sirree. Before we poke a little good-natured fun at Blood and Sand, let's give the usual Golden Silent Films podcast social media roundup. As usual, please join Golden Silence Cast on Instagram for up-to-date info on this little podcast. And for all of you rad folks on Twitter, just follow at GoldenSilence1 or just search for Golden Silence Cast and we will be there. And these sites and screen names will be in the episode description in case you're interested in checking us out and we would love to have you on board. At both social spaces, you'll get behind-the-scenes pics and info, upcoming episode information, and other fun and cool silent movie-related materials, and great photos of our official show cats. Also, if you're listening to this program on Apple Podcast or Spotify, do leave a review, a rating, or both. All those ratings and reviews really help a lot. The show is well past the 6,000 listen mark, and we hope to keep running those numbers higher and higher. Live your best review-leaving life and help our fun little show reach new folks. Whether getting us more exposure in the packed land of podcasts or letting us know how we can improve, we appreciate the feedback and always want to bring you the best show possible. and do subscribe to the Golden Silent Films podcast. While our output can be seemingly hit or miss, if you are subscribed, you will never miss an episode, and the moment we release new content, it will be downloaded right to your brain via listening device of choice. And we have a lot of cool stuff coming down the pipe for this third season, and we don't want you to miss a second. Now, it's never too late to catch up and watch this hilarious film before we fully embark on spoofy shenanigans. As we've said many times before, do feel free to head over to YouTube and check it out. The existence of Mud and Sand on the old YouTubes is a bit hit-or-miss affair. The first one I watched had no inner titles, oddly enough. But after a bit of trial and error, some great versions were eventually found. They all had varying levels of quality, but as long as you catch one with the titles, you should be all set. Now, if you're a lover of physical media, there is also a Kino DVD collection called Slapstick Symposium, the Stan Laurel Collection, Volume 2. This disc contains a handful of Stan Laurel's solo shorts, with Mud and Sand included. Unfortunately, I was unable to catch that version. Usually, we do our best to check these films out in the best ways and versions possible, but we can't go out all out every time, as much as we'd like to. So, that is the long-winded way of saying we'll be digging into the YouTube version today. While we're shouting out what versions to watch, I would be remiss if I didn't also talk a bit about the books that really gave a lot of research into this episode. First off, in the intro we mentioned John Connolly. His book, a novel, was amazing. It was definitely a different take on the traditional biography. His book puts you in the mind of Stan Laurel through the highs and lows of the legendary comedian's life and career. It is a read I cannot recommend enough. The second source book to be highlighted is called Stan Without Ollie, the Stan Laurel solo films, 1917 to 1927, written by Ted Okuda and James L. Niebauer. Though the title is a bit of a mouthful, it's totally worth checking out for any fan of Stan the Man. This book breaks down every solo Stan film in great detail, with a ton of great background information on all these early classic films. Both of these books are must-haves and easy to find on various book-selling websites. But they are welcome additions to any film lover's book collection, so I can assure you, print is not dead. For this Mud and Sand-inspired trip down biography lane, we're going to start off with a sort of, but not really, love story between two folks in this film. That would be the common-law couple of Stan Laurel and May Laurel, née Dahlberg. And don't worry, we'll explain all the twists and turns. We're going to give you a quick bio dip now to get us up to speed at the beginning of the Laurel and Dahlberg relationship. Now, if you want a deeper dive into Stan's life, do rack up episode 20 from our second season. In that one, we took a deep dive into the life of Stan Laurel and his relationship with longtime comedic partner, Oliver Hardy. First, let's talk about the feminine side of the equation, May Dahlberg. May Charlotte Dahlberg was born on May 24, 1888. She was born and raised in Brunswick, Victoria, Australia. By 1905, she had begun to earn a reputation performing on stages throughout Australia as a singer and dancer, earning rave reviews. Moving ahead to 1906, Dahlberg married baritone singer and fellow performer Rupert Cuthbert while in Hobart, Tasmania. The two would have a child, Rupert Clifton Sachs Cuthbert, in 1908. By 1913, the two would make their way to the United States. That marriage would not last long. Or would it? As you ponder that, let's take a gander at the star of this picture and May Dahlberg's significant other, Stan Laurel. The comedian was born Arthur Stanley Jefferson in Lancashire, England, on June 16, 1890. He was raised in a family of entertainers with an especially successful father, whose influence would exert itself over his career. Stan would eventually catch the bug himself. By 1910, he was working as Stan Jefferson in Fred Karno's acting and comedy troupe. This group also included a young Charlie Chaplin. In fact, Stan served as the understudy to Chaplin for a spell. This troupe, and Karno specifically, worked in music halls all over and helped to nurture and improve Laurel's knack for slapstick. The Karno crew all but disbanded by the spring of 1914. In Stan's sights next was the glitz and glamour of the United States. Had Laurel remained in Britain, serving an apprenticeship to his father before assuming control of one of the family's theaters, women might not have been a temptation for him. At the very least, he would have been constrained by a combination of finances and anonymity. Instead, he left for the United States and changed his name, writes John Connolly in an article for the New Statesman. The next bit of personal and professional news came in 1917. While performing in California, Dahlberg met and formed a variety act with Stan Laurel, who was still going by Stan Jefferson at that time. Now let's hop back into that marriage of Mae Dahlberg. Going back to an article by author John Connolly for the Daily Mail, Connolly writes, Mae claimed to be a widow, despite the fact that her husband Rupert was alive and well, if conveniently elsewhere. Mae became Jefferson's common-law wife. When he changed his name, she styled herself Mae Laurel, although they never married. The stage act of Stan and Mae Laurel played all over the United States and Canada. Their working relationship moved to the movie screen with the 1917 short Nuts in May. This was the big screen debut of both Laurel and Dahlberg. Though this start seemed to be the beginning, it would only be a false start, and the series of films Laurel was promised never materialized. Connolly explains the importance of Mae from the viewpoint of Stan. He writes, She is a creature of craft and ambition, but Mae has already begun the process of willing into being the man he is to become. Without Mae, he would still be in the shadow of his father. Though Stan and Mae never married, as professional partners they lived together as common-law husband and wife from 1917 until 1925. Connolly explains this emotional tug-of-war Stan felt in his relationship with Mae Dahlberg. Connolly writes, He loves Mae, but Mae drives him crazy. He cannot function without her, but he can no longer function with her unless he first has a drink or two to steady his nerves. He is loyal to her and she to him, but he is more loyal to himself and she to herself. Mae believes that she could yet be a leading lady. If he becomes a success, Mae will be a success with him. As on stage, so on the screen, or thus Mae reasons. But Mae is not good enough, and he cannot bring himself to tell her this. Connolly continues, Mae is not a lead. He knows it, and the studios know it. But Mae does not, and so it remains unspoken. And when he drops down a rung to take character parts with Larry Seaman, Mae does not descend with him. Character parts are beneath her, and Mae believes they should be beneath him too. They will not make him a star, and so they will not make her a star either. Not that he does not love Mae. He does, for all their travails. He loves that she does not question his decision to leave vaudeville. He loves that she trusts in his gifts. But Mae wants to work. Mae wants to be in pictures. And if he is to have a starring role, then Mae must star alongside him. He now makes it a condition of his employment, Connolly finishes. The relationship continues to disintegrate. When Stan worked for Hal Roach early on, there were clauses in his contract stipulating that Mae be given roles in his films. As his career moved and grew, this stipulation soon caused trouble. After leaving Roach and signing with Joe Rock, no such clauses would be offered or given. Mae was effectively cut out of Laurel's career. This lack of Mae only furthered the breakdown of the coupling. In his heart, Connolly writes, Laurel acknowledges that he did not sign with Joe Rock solely because of the percentages. He signed because of Mae. He signed because Mae will not tolerate being sidelined. Mae will either be forced to change or to leave. But Mae cannot change, and so Mae must leave. By the time the relationship officially came to an end, rumors and whispers surrounded the exit of Mae. Connolly explains, Later, stories will be told that Mae is put on a boat back to Australia with a ticket paid for by a loan from film producer Joe Rock, that Mae is given her jewelry to take with her, that cash is left in the care of the purser and handed over only when the ship is at sea, just to ensure that Mae cannot renege on the deal. Perhaps there is no ship, Connolly writes. Perhaps there is no purser, but there is money. Not as much as Mae wants, not as much as she is worth, but better than the alternative. Mae takes the money and vanishes, for a time. Mae was older than Laurel and nowhere near as talented. When he moved to Hollywood, she came with him. But by 1925, Laurel was in love with another actress, Lois Nielsen. When it became clear to everyone that Mae was holding Laurel back both in his career and his love life, everyone, that is, except Mae, She was paid to disappear, Connolly wrote for the Daily Mail. Everyone can agree that May returned to her home country of Australia. In fact, an Australian newspaper, The Sun, from March 3, 1925, explains her return. The article reads, Miss May Laurel, an Australian actress who went to America 9 years ago and has been playing in motion pictures and vaudeville in many cities of the United States in that time, returned to Sydney by the Sonoma today. She was homesick, she said, and decided to come back for a trip. Miss Laurel, who is a native of Melbourne, will stay for some time and may appear on the Sydney stage while she is here. Now, one of the things that added to the downfall of this relationship was the introduction of another actress, Lois Nielsen, who we mentioned earlier. Laurel and Nielsen were living together in 25, and by 26, August 13 to be exact, they were married. They had had a daughter named Lois in 1927 and a son in 1930, though the son, named Stanley, only lived 9 days. The two divorced in December of 1934. The rough road to love was far from over for the comedian. In 1935, Laurel married Virginia Ruth Rogers. This marriage would not last long. Still harboring feelings for Lois, Stan and Ruth would divorce. In the midst of Stan Laurel's personal tumult, Mae Dahlberg would make her return to our story. An AP report from the December 7, 1937 San Bernardino Sun newspaper breaks down May's litigious actions. The article reads, The $1,000 a month maintenance suit of May Laurel against dour-faced Stan Laurel, film comedian, was dismissed today when it was called for trial, attorneys explaining that a settlement had been effected out of court. She claimed in her suit that she was the comedian's former vaudeville partner and that they traveled together and were billed as Stan and May Laurel. Although the terms of the settlement today were not disclosed, lawyers said it had been stipulated that the woman never was Laurel's legal wife. May Laurel had asked for an accounting and division of community property she estimated at $100,000. Her suit was filed shortly after Laurel was sued for divorce by Virginia Ruth Laurel, to whom he was married in 1934. She won a divorce December 24, 1936, but the couple has since been reconciled and parted again, and the interlocutory decree still stands on the court records. Not one to give up on the concept of love, Laurel celebrated the dawning of 1938 by marrying Vera Ivanova Shuvalova on New Year's Day, 1938. His former wife, Ruth, smelled something fishy and accused Laurel of bigamy. But in this case, this new marriage was indeed legit and legal. This new marriage was often volatile and was not long for this world. He and Ileana separated in 1939 and divorced in 1940, with Ileana surrendering all claim to the Laurel surname on February 1, 1940 in exchange for $6,500. In 1941, Laurel remarried Virginia Ruth Rogers, only to be divorced a second time in early 1946. Not long after, May of 1946, he married Ida Kateva Raphael, to whom he would remain married until his death on February 23, 1965, at the age of 74. And that is the wild tale of the love and loss of Stan Laurel and May Dahlberg. We'll leave it with a snippet from writer John Connolly as he describes Laurel looking back on his tumultuous relationship with May Dahlberg. Connolly writes, At the Oceana Apartments, he counts the years with May. 6, 8, which is it? 8, he decides, give or take. How many of them were happy? Most. Some. He knew it could not end well, not with a husband in the wings and a son and a common law bed, but May held on to the fantasy for as long as she could. It was all May had. Still, there were good times, happy years, and the conclusion, when it came, would not be entirely hateful. Not at first. Next, we're going to continue our look at the Chaplin family tree, while still not making contact with that ever-elusive Charlie branch. This time, we're going to be focusing on a Chaplin half-brother, Wheeler Dryden. Now, George Dryden Wheeler Jr. was born on August 31st, 1892 in Brixton, London, England. He was the youngest of three boys born to Hannah Hill Chaplin. His father, however, was George Dryden Wheeler Sr., but also went under the name Leo Dryden on stage. In his infancy, Leo Dryden, or George Dryden Wheeler Sr., would leave the troubled Hannah and her two sons from another father, Sidney and Charlie Chaplin. In an interview with the paper The Looker On out of Calcutta, India, Wheeler Dryden talks about his early life. This interview was in the January 12, 1918 edition of the paper. And in case you are curious, he will explain why this interview is coming from Calcutta. This great resource can be found, along with a ton of other really cool stuff, at charliechaplinarchive.org. It's a bit on the long side, but bear with us. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in it. Now, Dryden would say about his upbringing, "When I was about 3 months old, my parents quarreled and parted, and I was taken away by my father and reared apart from Sid and Charlie, who stayed with my mother. I first arrived in India in January of 1912, when my father brought out a variety company from England and opened up at the Grand Opera House, Calcutta. In those days, under the stage name Leo George, I used to impersonate various characters from Charles Dickens' novels, and my work was very different from what it is now, that is to say, more dramatic than comic. My father returned to England after his Far Eastern tour, but I stayed in India, being desirous of seeing such famous sights as the Taj Mahal at Agra and the residency at Lucknow, which I subsequently did when touring with other variety companies." Dryden finishes up by explaining how he came about his stage name. Dryden explains, "In October 1914, I joined the Howitt Phillips Company during their Calcutta season. The name Leo George was scarcely suitable for the legitimate stage. I discarded it and adopted the name Wheeler Dryden instead, which, apart from being more appropriate, had the advantage of incorporating my real name and my father's stage name, the exact combination I had long wanted. In 1915, after the rise to fame of his half-brothers, his father told him the backstory of his true origin, that being his real mother Hannah and his two cinematic siblings. That realization would lead Wheeler to reach out to the two Chaplin boys. Any reunion Wheeler had in mind would require patience and perseverance. It would take 2 whole years for the youngest half-brother to finally get in touch with Chuck and Sid. By 1918, he had joined them fully stateside. Wheeler would enjoy some moderate big-screen success upon joining his half-siblings in America, initially at least. He started strong with the drama Tom's Little Star in 1919 and False Women and Penrod in 1921. His co-starring role with Stan Laurel came in 1922's Mud and Sand. By 1925, his on-screen career would start to wind down. Though things were slowing down, that did not mean he was done with the entertainment industry. Dryden would take his talents to the bright lights of Broadway, where he would appear in 10 shows between 1925 and 1939. Despite having stepped away from film, he would still dip his talented toes in on occasion. In 1928, he adapted and co-directed the British International Pictures production of A Little Bit of Fluff, or Skirts as it was known in the States. His partner in direction was the prolific Jess Robbins, and the film starred Dryden's hilarious half-sibling, Sidney Chaplin. This film would mark the final films in the careers of both Robbins and Sid Chaplin. Romance was in the air for Wheeler when he married Alice Chappell, a dancer at Radio City Music Hall. The couple would have a son, Spencer Dryden. Wheeler would prove integral to the creative team of his half-brother Charlie. On the film blog Travelanche, an article by Trav S.D. takes us into the cinematic endeavors. He writes, "Wheeler Dryden was the assistant director and did some voiceover work on The Great Dictator in 1940. He was associate director and played a bit role in Monsieur Verdoux in 1947, and he had a slightly larger speaking role as a doctor and acted as Chaplin's personal assistant on Limelight in 1952. Just when you thought the biographies were over, oh no, no, they drag you back in. They drag us all back in. Or more specifically, we format the show in such a way as to keep the biographies rolling well into our pre-production segment. This will all tie nicely together, I assure you. So with all of that in mind, Maxwell Henry Aronson was born on March 21st, 1880 in Little Rock, Arkansas. In showbiz circles, this fellow would be more well-known as Bronco Billy Anderson. A deep dive into Mud and Sand wouldn't be complete without a look at the original big-screen cowboy himself, Bronco Billy. He was a larger-than-life character deserving of his own spotlight episode. But for now, we're going to hit you with a mini-bio to set the scene. He was a man of many talents, including acting, writing, directing, producing, and just generally a pioneer of the Western film genre. Anderson was a man who could legit say his roots are intertwined with the roots of film in America. Anderson's showbiz story really took hold in one of the United States' earliest and most well-known films, The Great Train Robbery. That legendary 1903 Edwin Porter picture would see Bronco Billy play not just one, but multiple roles. By 1907, Anderson was in Chicago flexing his entrepreneurial muscles with business partner George Kirk Spoor. Together, the two would form S&A Studios. As we look at the tally sheet, Bronco Billy Anderson would act in over 300 short films, with a hefty chunk of those being westerns, where he became one of the earliest cowboy stars. While Spoor ran the company from Chicago, Anderson was out and about filming all over the West Coast. In 1916, Anderson sold his share in the company and retired from acting. The cinematic cowboy would make a return, but this time he was behind the camera. One of his ventures was Mack Don Pictures, which he formed in 1920, writes Okuda and Niebauer. The two continue, after reestablishing himself as a producer of popular Western films, Anderson looked into starting a comedy unit. He hired S&A friends like Ben Turpin and Billy Armstrong to appear in what he called jolly comedies. When these films failed to take off, Anderson formed Amalgamated Producing. In January of 1921, a film entitled The Lucky Dog was produced, featuring Stan Laurel in the lead, and in a small role as a hold-up man, Oliver Hardy. Over the next 40 or so years, Bronco Billy would come out of retirement for various roles in various films. But he would always return to the retired life not long after. His final role was a cameo in 1965's The Bounty Killer. The last few years of his life saw him living at the motion picture and television country house and hospital in Woodland Hills, California. He died in 1971 at the age of 90. So, that was a long-winded way of introducing the producer of this picture and his star status in the Hollywood community. We now know what a great and hilarious film Mud and Sand turned out to be, but going into filming, it was still an unknown quantity and a big roll of the dice for Bronco Billy. Shortly after filming began, though, folks in the know saw they had something special on their hands. The production dates of this film were September 18 through October 1922. This flick was filmed at Fine Arts Studio and was released on November 13, 1922 by Amalgamated Producing. John Connolly writes, Metro is lukewarm about what it has seen so far. He, Laurel, falls back on burlesques. Rudolph Valentino is the biggest star in the world. Rudolph Valentino's latest picture is Blood and Sand. So he will become Rhubarb Vaseline in Mud and Sand. 26 minutes, 3 reels. It is a lot of money for Bronco Billy Anderson to invest, even with the Metro deal. But maybe this is the way to go. And it's good. It's good from the first sight of the dailies, and it's good in the edit, and it's good on the screen. What exactly was so good, you ask? I suppose that's probably the best segue into our podcast world-famous movie breakdown. Let's get the ball rolling with some of the opening credits that you may recognize from their original forms in Blood and Sand. Then, actual movie time. Stan Laurel as Rhubarb Vaseline. Julie Leonard as Caramel. Leona Anderson as Filet de Sol. And May Laurel as Pavelewski, and Wheeler Dryden as Sapo, directed by Gilbert Pratt, with cinematography by Irving Reese, and titles by Thomas N. Miranda. Mud and Sand, Part 1. We start the film at the home of the most ambitious one, Rhubarb Vaseline. His mother is quite upset at her son. Mon Dios, I sent Rhubarb for a sack of flour at sunrise. Where can he be? She asks. Much like Blood and Sand, here we also get the sister and brother-in-law voicing their displeasure at Rhubarb and his life choices. The brother-in-law explains, She's right. Ever since he met that bullfighter Sapo, all we get out of him is bull, bull, bull. Homeward bound with Mother's Flower, we finally see Rhubarb and Sapo. They are dancing and merrily strolling their way down a dirt road, dragging a bag of flour behind them. Turning to Okuda and Niebauer, we get a look at this scene in comparison to its original version with Valentino. The two write, Laurel offers a savage lampoon of this sequence as he is shown skipping down the road with his friend Sapo, both holding on to the same lariat and behaving in an overly effeminate manner. As they mosey, Rhubarb sees a bustle of activity nearby. They go to check it out and see some bullfights are about to go down and folks are signing up. With everyone there, they are ordered to sit on a bench in the order of fighter. As each Toreador enters the arena, their name is marked. They enter the arena and are soon stretchered out, with a zero written next to their name for failure to take out even one bull. Here we get some fun comedic bits with Laurel as he moves up and down in line, much to the chagrin of the serious bullfighters. The first volunteer, Don Socks, is taken out on a stretcher. The second volunteer, Don Pedro, has a similar fate. His friend, Don Sapo, is next and does no better. Seeing this only raises Rhubarb's anxiety. Next in line is his good friend Sapo. Like I said, Sapo does not do very good in there. "Goodbye, old pal," Rhubarb says. "Be sure and save a bull for me." Sapo enters after the two friends shake hands. Sapo's luck is about the same as everyone else's. He is soon stretchered out. Rhubarb tries to console his injured friend. It has no effect as Sapo soon dies. Vengeance must be exacted on these beasts, much like the original Blood and Sand. Rhubarb announces himself as Don Vaseline and goes in to avenge his friend. It takes a quick comedy bit for Rhubarb to get into action. A bull gets thrown over the gate, then another one comes flying out. Rhubarb comes out, marks up a score of 3 in cocky anticipation, but on the third, he is the one thrown over the gate. He erases the third score and re-enters. We are told this is the sad end of a bullfight, but not for Rhubarb. In fact, the third bull comes out on a stretcher and Rhubarb leaves triumphant. The crowd carries him through the streets, where he meets an old school friend, sweet little Caramel, with her father. He tells her of his great deeds and bravery. She gives him a rose, which has accidentally become dipped in black paint. He fails to notice this and gives the flower a big sniff, covering much of his face with black paint. Rhubarb brings home the dough, though. In another nod to Blood and Sand, we get some more goat interaction. Always, always love that goat interaction. As he bends to open the door, the goat sees it as too much of a temptation and butts him and knocks him through the door. His mom chases him with a broom. When things calm down, though, he tells her the sad news. "Mama dear, poor Sap got his today," he tells her. This makes her incredibly sad and worried for her boy. She cries until she is shown a bag of money he won at the bullfight. Her spirits raise when he gives her half. "That'll keep you in tomatoes and garlic for 2 years," he tells her. Vaseline's local victory wins him an offer to fight the Bulls of Madrid, and that night, much like Valentino before him, he serenades Caramel under her window while a dog howls. He is all dressed up in an official matador garb. He climbs up the trellis to her window, but it breaks off. His friend, who is playing the guitar, gives him a lift up to the balcony. Very, very suave, I assure you. Caramel asks, "Rhubarb, they tell me in Madrid they drink a great deal. Will you drink anything?" "Anything," he responds. He pulls out a jewelry box from his coat and gives it to her. It's empty. He finds a second box with a necklace in his coat and says they will meet at sunrise to marry. "Caramel, be ready at sunrise. We will be married and leave on the 5:15, he explains. "Darling," he adds as he prepares to climb down, "I am going away to Madrid, but nothing shall ever part us," he says as the balcony breaks apart and he falls to the ground. Mud and Sand Part 2. After throwing the bull for 2 years, Vaseline becomes the idol of Spain. Crowds cheer him on as he rides a horse through the streets. But when he tries to rear the horse, he falls off into a muddy puddle. Nothing is ever smooth sailing in a comedic short, I have learned. Our gaze turns to the Café Española, a famous rendezvous for picadors, toreadors, matadors, floradors, commodores, and cuspidors. This is where we get our requisite dancing scene and meet the film's Donna Sol in Filet de Sol, played by Leona Anderson. Filet de Sol, we are told, could put her fins around any poor fish in Spain. Before we move on, let's take a little look at Leona Anderson. She was born on April 3rd, 1885. Her birth name, however, was Leona Aronson. If that last name sounds familiar, it should. Good listening. She is the younger sister of Mud and Sand producer Bronco Billy Anderson, whom we talked about earlier. She would appear on screen for her brother's SNA Studios a handful of times, starting in 1914. To continue our season-long theme of one degree of separation from Charlie Chaplin, Leone appeared with the legendary silent star in the 1915 comedy In the Park. Now, Rhubarb has gone to Café Española to dance. There he meets Filet del Sol, who will be the temptress of this picture. But she is not the only lady he will meet in this scene. We are also introduced to Pavelski, the premio dancer of Madrid, in this picture at least. Pavelski throws a rose and starts to dance with Rhubarb. When she ends up with her head in his lap, Rhubarb releases a stream of soda in her face, accidentally. They take to the dance floor as Filet del Sol looks on. Filet del Sol watches his weird way of dancing with interest. Two rival matadors sabotage this odd dance moves by making him slip. Rhubarb and Pavelski finish their dance standing near a fountain. When Filet del Sol starts flirting from afar, Rhubarb drops Pavelski in said fountain. Sacramento, San Diego, we shall avenge you, the rival matadors yell at Pavelski. Let's step away from the film for a moment and get back to Leona Anderson. With an acting career that fizzled out by the early 20s, she was due for a career reinvention. That radical, screeching change came in the early 1950s, with Anderson becoming the self-proclaimed world's most horrible singer. Her unique form of singing graced the Ernie Kovacs show multiple times. The record company, Unique Records, released her full-length album, Music to Suffer By, in 1957. This album included such bangers as Limburger Lover and Rats in My Room. Every track slaps, I assure you. Later that night, he makes his way into Filet del Sol's apartment. Here we get great gags at the expense of the scene in Blood and Sand where Gallardo goes to Doña Sol's place. This even adds the weird fan servants, which is great. Rhubarb tries everything he can to sneak out, but none of it works. We also get some great gags from this as well. Much like Gallardo, Rhubarb can only fight the temptress off for so long. Having fallen for her fins, Rhubarb forgets to go home. Filet comes down the stairs, all seductive-like, at which point Rhubarb kisses her hand. Just as they embrace, Caramel enters with Rhubarb's mother. Filet throws her purse down. "Pick it up, slave," she yells at Rhubarb, which he does and hands it to her. Next, he pleads his case to Caramel. "Oh, sweet Caramel, I'm innocent. Honestly, I am," he tries to explain. "I didn't mean anything wrong. I just wanted to see her gowns." Caramel and Rhubarb's mother leave as Filet del Sol laughs at the matador. "Now see what you've done," he yells at her. "You've ruined my life, and you'll pay," he tells her as she continues to laugh. And with that, he storms out. Deserted by his wife and brokenhearted, Vaseline prepares for the last bullfight of the season. Here we get a hilarious send-up of the dressing room scene from Blood and Sand. Rhubarb gets dressed behind a screen, and his assistants give him a large lollipop. It is really good stuff. It's hilarious and spot on. In this final fight, we are told, Vaseline will kill the most vicious bull in Spain. This bull that Rhubarb will be facing has killed 10 men. As he is getting dressed, he falls out the window and lands on the bull. He quickly escapes and returns to getting dressed. He styles his hair in various ways with the assistance of a big tub of Vaseline. As he makes his final preparations, an ill omen of lightning strikes outside. This lightning strike hits him and causes a Z pattern in his parting of his hair after it strikes him. A street full of onlookers and well-wishers await him outside. Mud and Sand, Part 3. It is time for the parade to the arena. Rhubarb is cheered the whole way. Paying more attention to girls than where he is going, he falls through the wrong door, and a bull escapes into the streets, chased by a picador. The crowd disperses in terror. Rhubarb eventually runs into the arena, thinking he's safe. But he is not. It is now the big showdown with that killer bull. The crowd cheers, but Rhubarb disencourages them, if that's even a word. He tells them, "Don't. You'll encourage the bull." Writers Ted Okuda and James L. Niebauer tell us more about this climactic arena showdown. They write, "The climactic bullfight affords Laurel an opportunity for some splendid physical comedy, as he tries to attract the attention of the apathetic beast by waving his cape and launching into a series of nonsensical dance movements. In the bullring, the crowd adores him, but in her luxury box, Filet de Sole hopes to see his downfall. She eventually becomes quite bored, yawning as Rhubarb fights for his life. With the film coming to a close, let's take one more detour and finish our story of Leona Anderson's career and life. Classic horror film House on Haunted Hill in 1959 marked the final on-screen appearance of Leona. In that memorable movie, she played Mrs. Slides. Not a bad cinematic note to go out on. The actress and songbird died in 1973 in Fremont, California. From the crowd, Pavelewski tells those two rival matadors from earlier that she must kill him. "There's the man who caused me to take a bath. He must die," she explains. She gives them a bottle of ether. They soak his cloak in the sleepy substance. We get more silliness on the arena grounds from Rhubarb versus the Bull. Rhubarb eventually picks up the ether-soaked cloak. The matador picks it up and starts waving it in front of the Bull's nose. The Bull falls asleep. But it's not just the Bull who grows drowsy. Rhubarb starts feeling it too and staggers around the arena in slow motion. The crowd goes crazy seeing that Rhubarb has defeated the vicious Bull. They throw hats, lots of hats, so many hats, all in celebration of Rhubarb's incredible performance. Like I said, Rhubarb Vaseline is triumphant, but he ends up dying after being struck by a brick thrown by Pavelewski. A line of attendants make their way to the fallen matador and pour sand from buckets all over him until he is covered. And that's mud and sand. Before being totally over, though, the film leaves us with some advice. The film reads, "Moral: if you want to live long and be happy, cut out the Bull." So with the movie coming to an end, I have to say this was an incredibly fun watch. As a movie viewer, I loved spoof films my whole life. So I was especially excited to watch this, and it lived up to my expectations. Laurel's performance was top-notch. He was really killing it the whole runtime of the movie. Even when he wasn't doing big gags, the little stuff he did really helped the character and really helped the comedic factor of the movie. Another thing I really appreciated about this movie was it was kind of riding a fine line with some little dark humor, some black humor, which I love and appreciate, and I found it hilarious. The movie itself was incredibly funny, but I loved that dark subtext to it. I also love how compact this movie was. When you're rolling three reels or less, you don't have much time to get your point across. That shows a deft hand from Laurel and the film's director, Gilbert Pratt. This movie was so jam-packed with jokes and gags, to look away even for a second was to miss comedy gold. The buzz around this picture was great. Many of the reviews and papers and magazines really pushed the movie, and Stan Laurel in particular. In fact, Motion Picture News compared Stan to Chaplin and wrote that his performance in Mud and Sand was exquisite. In fact, if you don't believe me, here is the entire quote. Motion Picture News would write, "Every now and then there comes to the screen a young man who carries on, idiotically, who appears, casually observed, a mere clowning fool, but who, more thoughtfully considered, shows himself to be the rarest of all artists, a true buffoon, gifted with the power of bringing laughter, which is strangely close to tears. Such a man is Charlie Chaplin, and such a man, Stan Laurel, is by way of becoming fast." I wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment. This was an incredible display of what Stan Laurel could do. Unfortunately, this didn't lead to superstardom right away, but his performance definitely shows that star quality, that X factor, that it factor, and it shows what a raw talent he was and how he would build that into his career later on and become a legend. For as good and well-received as Stan and the film were received by critics and moviegoers alike, there was one glaring issue with Mud and Sand. Writer John Connolly explains this particular issue. He writes, from the perspective of Stan Laurel, "Only May is not good. May is a 28-year-old woman, if she is to be believed, which she is not, because she is 34 and looks 40, who is convinced that she is beautiful enough to play Pavelusky, the dancer and seductress who tempts the hero. Her common-law husband may love her fleshiness, but the camera does not, and may axe for people two cities away. And if the camera cannot help but magnify her failings, so also does it capture the hardness beneath. Connolly also takes us into the mind of Laurel at that first screening. Connolly writes, "At the first screening, he casts glances at May as she watches the screen. May does not see what he sees. May is enthralled by the figure she presents. May is in love with the possibility of herself. May could have a future in pictures, but not the one she imagines, not the one she believes is her due. May could be background, furniture, but May will never be a star. Afterwards, they celebrate with champagne. But he, Laurel, cannot meet her eye," Connolly tells us. In an August 2022 article for Medium.com entitled "People Relied on Mud and Sand for Three Ages," writer Alexander Raisin breaks down the early parody film thusly. Directed by Gilbert Pratt in 1922, he did a great job parodying Blood and Sand, with many scenes mocking the film. "I enjoyed Mud and Sand for what it's worth. The gags were hilarious, and it was nice to see parody films find their footing." Another interesting facet of this movie comes from the fact that it is a spoof, like we've been talking about. All of you fine listeners are sure, I'm sure aware of the concept of the spoof film, a film that mocks or takes loving jabs at a popular source material. In the case of this film, its spoofy nature really aided in the professional development of Stan Laurel. If we turn to the book Stan Without Ollie, the Stan Laurel solo films, 1917 to 1927, written by Ted Okuda and James L. Niebauer, we get a great look at this growth. They write, "Mud and Sand represents a major step in the development of Laurel's film career, and its success prompted him to embark on a series of burlesques of then-current movies. The format provided Laurel with an ideal framework for his comic gifts, as he now had sturdy and familiar stories upon which to hang imaginative and often outrageous visual gags. Additionally, it furnished him with a new outlet for his humor, by playing exaggerated versions of the original lead roles. Yet he also managed to imbue his performances with subtle touches that had been lacking in his previous starring vehicles. In the process of satirizing other actors, Laurel became a better actor himself." Nowadays, the notion of a spoof film doesn't really make you think of professional growth, right? There definitely was a golden age of it, but recent years have seen the spoof genre really aim for lowest common denominator comedy and easy reference gags. Not necessarily the most creative endeavors. Well, that's how I feel personally. So I found it incredible to read that a film like Mud and Sand really pushed Laurel and made him a better actor. Okuda and Niebauer add, "The satire is even more pointed if one is familiar with the corresponding scenes in Blood and Sand. Viewing this burlesque from a perspective nearly a century after the fact, it's easy to forget that the original film had been seen by virtually every member of the audience in 1922, making Laurel's satiric jabs seem all the more hilarious." As we lay this episode to rest, it is time to find out where your favorite silent stars are laid to rest. This is a segment where we join our favorite ill-fated cinematic matadors on the other side of the cemetery gates. The history, the art, the celebrity spectacle converge in Where Are They Now? Your guide to paying your respects to the stars that have entertained us so much. A great article from charliechaplin.com takes us through the later years of Wheeler Dryden. The article reads, "Though not as gifted as Chaplin, Wheeler was a competent actor who made his career both on stage and on screen. He became a permanent member of the Chaplin Studios in 1939, when he was appointed assistant director of The Great Dictator. He was later promoted to associate director for Monsieur Verdoux. Wheeler also appeared briefly in Limelight, Charlie Chaplin's last film made in the U.S. He remained in California after Charlie's departure and died on September 30, 1957, shortly after A King in New York was released in Europe. After Big Brother Charlie left America for Switzerland in 1952, Dryden put on his business hat and worked on his brother's behalf. He would handle the Hollywood business interests and affairs of Charlie Chaplin until 1954, when the studio was sold. In his final years, he would suffer bouts of mental illness and reclusiveness. These issues were exacerbated by issues in his half-brother Charlie's political life and his life in general during the period of increasing anti-communist actions by governments and Hollywood studios in the United States. Wheeler Dryden would pass away on September 30th, 1957, like we mentioned, at the age of 65 in South Pasadena, California. His death came not too long after the September 12th European release date of Brother Charlie's A King of New York. The Chaplin sibling, in death, would return to his home country of England. He was buried in Twickenham Cemetery in London, England. His grave can be found at Grave 111 in Section 1. His ashes were buried there on October 11th, 1957. With this episode ending, we want to thank you for returning to the arena with us. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast love spoof films, and we're happy to have shared this one with you. Did you enjoy this good-natured ribbing at the expense of blood and sand? What are some of your favorite spoof films? What solo Laurel films most activate the laugh centers of your brains? Let us know all that and more at the various social media hangouts of the Golden Silent Films podcast. On that note, if you have forgotten, we are on Instagram and Twitter. Let us know what you think about this episode. What silent movies, past or present, do you want us to dip into next? Our world of silent movie knowledge and experience is constantly growing, and we need your input to plan out our future views as we continue to roll through Season 3 of the Golden Silent Films podcast. You can do all that fun stuff at Golden Silence Cast on Instagram and at Golden Silence 1 on Twitter. And again, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast outlet that allows it, subscribe, rate, review. It helps us out a lot, and we love hearing your thoughts and ideas. We really, really appreciate all of your incredible support, and seeing how much you folks out there are listening only makes us want to make bigger and better episodes for all of you. We hope you had as much fun listening as we did making this. And all that being said, thank you to all of you fine listeners for all of your fine listening. And don't forget, the silence are golden, and the talkies, they're just a fad. John Connolly leaves us with a final thought on Stan Laurel and a line from a letter Stan wrote. Laurel would write, "If I had to do it over again, things would be a lot different. But not in this town or this business." Hollywood, Connolly explained, brought Laurel a career, acclaim, and a personal and professional relationship by which he came to be defined, but all at a price.